Blog Talk Radio.
This is Denise. You can go ahead and start. The audio isn't going to play for the song tonight.
Okay. Good evening and welcome to the Global Health Forum on Blog Talk Radio. This show is a public service of People to People, a not-for-profit 501c3 registered Ethiopian diaspora healthcare organization. I'm your host, Dr. Antana Hapte, Chairman of People to People's Board of Directors. Our topic for this evening is cardiology training and services in Ethiopia. Heart diseases in particular and non-communicable diseases in general are on the rise in emerging economies like Ethiopia. It's predicted that by 2020, non-communicable diseases will cause 7 out of every 10 deaths in developing countries. Cardiovascular diseases, diabetes, cancer, and chronic pulmonary diseases feature prominently in the non-communicable category. The burden of these diseases is disproportionately high as they tend to be chronic and give rise to multiple complications. Urbanization with a more sedentary lifestyle, less healthy diet, smoking, and increased life expectancy all contribute towards the increased incidence and prevalence of cardiovascular diseases. Although there are some variations in epidemiology between developed and developing countries with infectious diseases like rheumatic heart disease, malaria, and HIV playing a bigger role in the latter, atherosclerosis and hypertension are the major risk factors globally. There is no readily available data for the burden of cardiovascular diseases in Ethiopia. A retrospective registry review of admissions to the medical intensive care unit of Tukurambasa Referral Hospital from 1982 to 2012 showed a threefold increase in the number of patients who had cardiovascular disease as their primary diagnosis. Congenital heart disease and rheumatic heart disease are the leading causes of heart disease in children. And children with congenital heart disease in Africa fare dramatically worse than their counterparts in developed countries because of lack of resources. This leads to early death, congestive heart failure, and severe functional limitations. So what can be done to prevent, diagnose, and treat heart diseases in Ethiopia? What are some of the efforts currently underway to support the training of physicians specializing in cardiology and cardiac surgery? I'm joined by two experts this evening to discuss this very issue. Dr. Jignesh Shah is originally from India, with training and practice both in India and the United States. He completed a fellowship in cardiology and subspecialty training in cardiac electrophysiology at Boston's Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, a part of Harvard Medical School. He has a faculty appointment at the University of Kentucky in Lexington and a thriving practice at Boulder Community Health. His interests include arrhythmia care, pacemaker implant, and cardiac ablations. Dr. Shah is board certified in internal medicine, cardiovascular diseases, and clinical cardiac electrophysiology. He also holds a master's degree in epidemiology. Welcome to the show, Dr. Shah.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you and your audience.
And Dr. Roberto Amado Cataneo is a thoracic and cardiac surgeon practicing in Great Falls, Montana. He's board certified in thoracic surgery and is a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and a member of the Society of Thoracic Surgeons and the International Society of Endovascular Surgeons. Dr. Cataneo is originally from Argentina, where he went to medical school. He subsequently did his general surgery residency at Boston University and his fellowship in cardiothoracic surgery at Oregon Health and Science University. He has extensive experience in minimally invasive surgery, laser revascularization, and homograft valve replacement. Delighted to have you on the show, Dr. Cataneo.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So let me start with you, Dr. Shah. If you could please describe your clinical practice and the type of patients that you see.
Yes. So as you mentioned, I was trained first as an internist, after which I trained for cardiology. Once I underwent the training for cardiology, I further specialized in rhythm problems of the heart, or the electrical problem. So currently, I work at Boulder Community Health as a cardiac electrophysiologist. In this capacity, I see patients who have any kind of rhythm problems. My role is essentially to make sure my patient's heartbeats are regular and normal. And so anyone with abnormal heart rhythm automatically becomes my patient, and that is the scope of my practice in Boulder, Colorado.
Thank you. And Dr. Cattaneo, if you could also describe your practice and the type of surgeries that you perform.
Yes, my specialty is cardiothoracic surgery, mainly in the areas of adult cardiac surgery, including all types of valvular surgery, that is, valve repairs or valve replacements, and the care of patients with coronary artery disease, which includes performing coronary artery bypass surgeries, which is one of the most common operations that we do here in the United States. I also do thoracic surgery, which includes the surgery for lung cancer and other ailments of the chest and lung.
Okay, great. So as we're going to be talking a lot about valve replacements later in the program, if you could just mention what the different options for valve replacement are.
Okay, in the world of valve surgery, there are in general two big groups. The patients that can have a repair of their own native valve, and the ones that cannot have a repair for due to the type of pathology involving the valve and needing a replacement with an artificial valve. In the world of the replacement of the valves, there are different types of prosthetic or artificial valves that can be used. There are the so-called mechanical valves, which are valves made out of a special metal, and the valves that are made out of tissue are also called tissue valves or biologic valves, which usually come from either porcines, you know, porcine hearts that are used for the making of those valves, or valves that come from tissue out of the cows, the pericardium of the cow, which is the sac that surrounds the heart. So these are the so-called biologic or tissue valves. The big difference in between these two valves is the following. The mechanical valves will, for the most part, last the life of the patient. There is no mechanical failure related to the valve itself. So these valves are better used in younger population of patients where you expect many years of life. Therefore, this valve will be ideal because of the longevity of the prosthesis. In the case of the tissue valves, the problem is that these valves will degenerate if they are implanted in younger patients. So the usual cutoff for this type of valves is in the 60 to 65 years of age. So if you have a patient below that age, the tissue valve will not be a good type of prosthesis, because eventually within a period of 10 or 15 years, the valve will degenerate and will need replacement. So we do not like to use those valves in younger patients. So that is the main difference in between one and the other.
All right. Thank you very much. Let me return to you, Dr. Shah, and the rhythm problems that you manage. What are the major arrhythmias and how do they present, and what do your patients usually complain of?
Sure. So to begin with, let me explain to the audience that our heart is like a pump. And just like a pump, it receives electricity on a regular basis And after it receives electricity, it mechanically pumps blood to the rest of the body. So normal electrical activity is very regular at 60 to 100 beats a minute, kind of like this. However, in some patients, this electrical activity can go haywire. Sometimes it can be very slow. So instead of the nice, regular 60 to 100 beats a minute, they will have electrical activity at 40 beats a minute, kind of like this. And so on. And so the blood flow occurs only when this electrical activity takes place. And so the body receives less blood supply. And when it receives less blood supply, they complain of fatigue, shortness of breath, and sometimes chest pain, lightheadedness, dizziness. Some of them feel like they're going to pass out. That is related to slow heartbeat. At other times, patients have fast heartbeat, kind of like this. And at that time, the patients feel palpitation, but they may also feel shortness of breath, lightheadedness, dizziness. They may feel like they are going to pass out. In some cases, they may pass out. And in extreme situations, they may even die because of this abnormal rhythm. So my patients typically come to me with palpitation, skip beat, fatigue, shortness of breath, lightheadedness, dizziness, and sometimes passing out.
Okay. And then to continue on that theme, what are the common tests and procedures done to diagnose and treat these common arrhythmias?
So when patients come to me with the symptoms that I just mentioned, I have to figure out what kind of arrhythmias, what kind of heartbeats they are having. And so, say a patient comes to me with complaints of fatigue all the time, including when they are talking to me in the clinic setting. In that case, first of all, I listen to their history, take their detailed history, examine them with my stethoscope, examine their pulse and other vital parameters, and then get an EKG, an electrocardiogram, to see what abnormal rhythm the person is having at that point in time, which explains their symptoms at that point in time. However, sometimes patients tell me that they have these palpitations once a day, but not currently when they are in my clinic. So I give them kind of an EKG monitor called Holter monitor that they wear for 24 or 48 hours so that we can document these rhythm problems that correlate with their symptoms of palpitation on once a day basis. And so then we correlate the symptoms with the arrhythmia and make the diagnosis. Sometimes they don't even have the symptoms that frequently. They come and say it is happening only once a month. In that case, we give them a monitor, special type of monitor called event monitor, where they wear the CKG monitor for a month and they make recording as and when they have the symptoms. So then we correlate that EKG with the symptoms. And once we understand what kind of rhythm problem is causing their symptoms, then we go about correcting them, either with medication, with pacemakers, or other cardiac procedures such as ablation. So that is my routine approach to treatment of arrhythmia.
All right, thank you. I'm sure our audience will have more questions when we come to halfway of the show. Dr. Cattaneo, Can you explain to our audience what rheumatic heart disease is?
Well, rheumatic heart disease is an infectious disease that begins with a very simple infection of the throat, what we normally call the strep throat, which is an infection caused by a bacteria called the streptococcal bacteria. And this causes a very common infection of the throat, where the throat gets red and irritated and has white plaques and so forth. This is a very common disease that children get all over the world, here in the United States as well as in Ethiopia. This disease, which is a very simple and common disease, is treated with a very common and basic antibiotic, which is penicillin. So children that get these strep throats are treated with a shot of penicillin, and the infection goes away. This is what happens in the Western world. In places where penicillin is not really readily available, or where healthcare providers are not readily available to the population, the cases of streptococcal tonsillitis or pharyngitis go undiagnosed, and the patients get well without any treatment. And then the disease recurs, so they get another strep throat. And again, they don't get treated. And so some of these patients will develop the next step of the disease process, which is rheumatic fever. Rheumatic fever is an autoimmune disease that originates through the infection of the throat with the streptococcal bacteria. So the body develops an autoimmune response that originates the so-called rheumatic fever. Rheumatic fever is a more serious a process because it causes a generalized malaise and high fevers, infection of the heart, or carditis is called, and also involves the large joints on the body, like the knees, hips, and so forth. So this disease, acute rheumatic fever, again, needs to be treated with antibiotics, the same antibiotic that treats the strep throat that originated this second stage. Now, if patients don't get treated with antibiotics, penicillin, then they go on to develop a more significant process, which is an inflammatory process involving the heart valves. And this process, once this process is established, even when the rheumatic fever process has subsided, the damage caused to the valves goes on and leads to a progressive deterioration of the heart valve function that causes the so-called rheumatic heart disease or rheumatic valvular disease, which is the end stage of the process that originated with a simple strep throat that went untreated. So rheumatic heart disease, the way we know it, has been eradicated from the Western world back in the 80s with the early diagnosis of strep throats and the early treatment with penicillin. Unfortunately, this has not been the case in underdeveloped countries or countries with a poor healthcare system, and a lot of children affected with this simple throat infection go on to develop a lethal disease, which is rheumatic heart disease, which leads to heart failure and death.
Okay. So when in the process does a child with rheumatic valvular heart disease require surgical intervention?
Okay. What most of the children affected with rheumatic fever are in the early age, the process of rheumatic fever, you know, once it's solved, it starts, let's say, the process of destruction of the valves. And usually the valve problems start showing early in life. And most of these patients are in their early teens, and this is when they start manifesting the problems with the valve destruction, and then when they start developing signs of heart failure and so on. So this is when we get involved at this end stage, let's put it that way, of the disease. And like I said, you know, most of these patients are young patients, and we have done surgeries in Ethiopia in children as young as 10 years old with the valves, heart valves, that are totally destroyed by the process, and they are in heart failure and in need of a life-saving valve surgery.
Okay. So what is usually the prognosis after surgery? I'm sure there are a lot of factors that weigh into that, but generally how well do you expect the child to do once the surgery has been successfully completed?
Well, you know, the surgeries are obviously complex cardiac surgeries involving the heart valves, and many and most, I would say, most of these children or young adults have more than one valve involved with the process. Usually, the most common valve is the mitral valve, which is the main valve in the left side of the heart. The aortic valve and the tricuspid valve are two of the other valves that can be involved. Most of these children have more than one valve involved in the process. So if the disease and the operation is undertaken when the patient still has a reasonable, a good heart, a good cardiac function, then the results are better, and the longevity after the surgery is much better. If the patients come to surgery at a very end stage and they have very sick, very diseased hearts, then the life expectancy and the prognosis is not as good. So if the surgery is done at a early stage and the valve can be either repaired or replaced, then these children have a very good life expectancy, and they can live very nice, productive, and useful lives. So the idea is to diagnose the disease early on and select the patients that will benefit from surgery early so they can be put back into a normal life and expect a productive life for them.
Okay, great. Dr. Shah, Dr. Catania just explained that rheumatic valvular disease is almost non-existent in the developed countries, and that's certainly a big difference between developed and developing countries. But what are other major differences in the epidemiology of cardiac disease between developed and developing countries?
So in developed countries, in the U.S. and Western Europe, the major heart problems are coronary artery disease, like you mentioned, atherosclerotic heart disease, atrial fibrillation, congestive heart failure, and so on. These are diseases caused due to age-related issues, unhealthy lifestyle, poor diet, stress, genetics, etc. As far as the developing countries are concerned, like both you and Roberto mentioned, that rheumatic heart disease is a major one. But I want your listeners to realize that developed countries only suffer through these atherosclerotic diseases, atrial fibrillation, congestive heart failure, and those diseases. However, the developing countries, in addition to rheumatic heart diseases, have all these other problems also. So it is not that because they have rheumatic heart disease and infectious problems, they are immune to the problems of the developed world. They are facing it from both sides, and that is why the burden of disease is much more in the developing countries as opposed to the developed countries. And like Roberto rightly mentioned, that if you treated the infection early, as it is done in developed countries, it would be much easier. However, the paucity of medication, early use of medication, that is unavailable in the developing countries, that leads to rheumatic heart disease and further problems down the road.
Great. And I just wanted to mention also that Ethiopia has trained and deployed thousands of healthcare workers now who go door to door in every village and serve as the initial contact to the healthcare system. So they're probably best situated to educate parents about, you know, streptococcal tonsillopharyngitis, and even when they have to do secondary prevention with antibiotic prophylaxis, which takes years of treatment, it's still certainly much cheaper and much more effective than bulb replacement. So before I open up the line for our audience, I wanted to hear from both of you your experiences in Ethiopia. Let me start with you, Dr. Shah. If you could, highlight the project that you're spearheading in Ethiopia, please.
Absolutely. So in terms of my experience, I want to talk about my personal experience and my professional experience. Personally, I think Ethiopia is a wonderful place. I love the attitude of the people. They are warm, welcoming, and friendly. The food is fantastic. The natural beauty is unique. Every time I'm there, I'm made to feel at home. I feel like Ethiopia is a home to me. However, when you like a country this much, you always want it to do better and be the best. I can see that Ethiopia is making tremendous progress in building infrastructure such as roads, telecommunications. I think this will help the nation very much. In healthcare, Ethiopia has just started. I know there are traditional methods, and many of them are useful, but we also need modern medicine, especially many things in modern medicine that work faster and better. And this is where I think Ethiopia has a lot farther to go. So I see that there are three major challenges for modernizing the healthcare of Ethiopia. One is infrastructure, two is medicine, and three is trained, specialized healthcare providers. Let me take a moment to explain to you in detail. In terms of infrastructure, the hospitals are fairly old. Equipment are outdated by a decade or two and are not functional in many cases. For example, there are some equipment, especially in cardiology, which are considered the norm in the developed country for the past three decades. No cardiologist in the developed world would work without these equipment. These are not available in Ethiopia. We are trying to do our best to remedy this deficiency. Number two is the medication, and the same holds true for medication. Some of the basic medications are not available, and even if they are, the supply is sporadic and unreliable. We have to work to make sure that medications are available for all Ethiopians. And third, which is mostly the sphere of my work, Ethiopia has general practitioners, basic internists, and surgeons, but very, very few specialists, such as cardiologists, kidney specialists, gastroenterologists, etc. Nursing care is also inadequate, since nursing training is inadequate. We have to start working to ensure that we can train these specialists. To me, when I talk about Ethiopia and Ethiopia's healthcare, I think of my patient, Tessie. Tessie is a 15-year-old. With rheumatic heart disease, which is, as Roberto explained, strep infection, which has now killed her heart valve so that she's having difficulty breathing. Her family brought her to Jimma University after 2 days of travel from our village. When she came to us, we admitted her to the hospital and prescribed medication. Thankfully, the medication were available at that point. Unfortunately, the family could only afford 2 days' worth of it, whereas she needed this for the long term. So we needed medications at that point in time. Further, if we had the basic equipment, we could have opened up her valve with a 20-minute balloon valvuloplasty procedure and send her home. But we don't have the equipment, and we do not have the cardiac specialist who can perform this procedure to relieve her of her symptoms and save her life. So to me, my 15-year-old Tessie is the face of healthcare of Ethiopia. And we can save her in Ethiopia, we will say we have made progress. And what are we going to do about this? Do we just Tessie's fate deal with it? My answer is no. And I know all of your listeners' answers will also be no. We are building a team to carry on a successful project. We are currently working to build the infrastructure and human capacity in cardiology. We are training a total of 6 internists at Jimma University and Bahidar University in cardiology, with the plan to get them to adequately train so as to provide cardiac care in their respective region. This is a collaborative work between the real world and the digital world. This is a collaborative work between Ethiopia, India, and the US. What I'm trying to do is to put the trainee through 2 years of intense training, after which we will assess, evaluate, and examine them. And if they pass the test at the end of 2 years, they will be certified as cardiologists by these universities. So Ethiopia will have trained cardiologists. Ethiopian people will have the benefit of getting the best cardiologists right at home. Allow me a couple more minutes to explain my project in detail.
Sure.
We have selected trainees who have agreed to stay back and work in Ethiopia. We give them lectures regularly, cardiology lectures regularly. The trainees get live lectures when our volunteer faculty teachers visit their university. We also meet them twice a week online to give lectures using the internet. These lectures get recorded and loaded on the website called www.ethiopiacardiology.org so that my trainees can go back and review the information again and again at their leisure. We also utilize this website to provide them with digital copies of cardiology books, cardiology articles that they have access to 24/7. Also, then my trainee is doing EKGs. They load up the EKGs on the website and we train them to interpret. Furthermore, now we are beginning to train them for echocardiogram. Recently, Lily Berhe, an Ethiopian person who is a specialist living in the U.S., went to Jimma University and trained them to perform echocardiogram. Furthermore, these trainees go to India for 6 to 8 weeks at a time and train at Star Hospital, where they are trained to perform and interpret 500 echocardiograms. When they come back from training, they perform these echocardiograms, take the recordings, once again load it onto the website so that we can interpret these echocardiograms with them. These trainees also see cardiac patients with us, volunteer cardiologists, and they visit their hospital. And we train them to provide cardiac care to these patients. When they are physically not in their hospital, they can still load up their case history, their lab values, and we train them to take care of these patients by case discussion online. And as I mentioned, after 2 years, they will be examined and they will be certified as cardiologists by these universities. We are also working with the hospitals to procure more instruments and equipment in the coming year, so that we can continue to train them on other aspects of cardiology, such as coronary angiogram, balloon valvuloplasty, etc. And in the future, we will plan to train nursing staff to provide cardiac nursing care, anesthesiologists to provide cardiac anesthesia, and surgeons to provide cardiac surgery. That is our effort in Ethiopia currently. Thank you.
Absolutely fantastic. I mean, this is like getting the best of both worlds. I mean, the technology and the advanced work of the developed countries, but also training and being familiar with the disease pattern in their own country. So this is absolutely amazing. And then before we go to the audience questions, I would like to also invite Dr. Cattaneo to share his experience in Ethiopia with our audience.
Okay, what we are doing right now is going to Addis Ababa to do a cardiac surgery. The cardiac center of Ethiopia is based in the grounds of the Black Lion University. It was established in the year 2009 by a group of English surgeons and the leadership of Dr. Belay in Addis Ababa. The center was built, it's a three-story building that is very well done. It has operating rooms, intensive care unit, and all the facilities to do cardiac surgery. The center is staffed by Ethiopian nurses and general staff, and by cardiologists and some thoracic surgeons that are based in either at the Black Lion University hospital or directly at the cardiac center. What we do is we go to Addis once a year. There are approximately six teams from different parts of the world that come to the center for periods of approximately 2 to 3 weeks each. And each team performs somewhere around the 10 to 15 surgeries per trip. So there are about 16 doing about 10 to 15 surgeries per mission. The cardiologists in the cardiac center do the selection of the patients that are in need for cardiac surgery. So when we arrive, the patients are presented to us. We review the cases with the local cardiologist, and we make the final decisions regarding the feasibility of surgery and whether, you know, the patient will benefit from the surgery and so forth and so on. And then we proceed with the surgeries for the, you know, for, like I said, a period of 2 weeks or something of that sort. After the surgery, the patients are, when we leave the center to return to, like in my case, to the U.S., the patients are cared by the cardiologists that staff the cardiac center. If a patient should have a problem after we leave, the next team arriving will take on the care of that patient. So there is some sort of continuity in what we're doing, because all these teams are already scheduled through the year, so there is some sort of an organized a plan to deal with all these surgeries. So, unfortunately, the main problem that we have as surgeons coming to do the surgeries is the lack of materials to perform the surgeries. That means that we, as a team, have to bring all the disposable products that are needed for cardiac surgery, including the prosthetic valves that we talked about it before, medications and everything else. So we come and we are really self-sufficient in the sense that we are prepared to do X number of surgeries. And that's the kind of the materials and medications that we bring. Unfortunately, at the moment, there is no enough local financial support to stock the center with all the medications and all the disposable materials that are needed for heart surgery. So each team has to bring their own stuff to be able to perform the surgeries. Unfortunately, at the moment, there is no definitive plan that I know to solve this problem. We have been in contact with some of the people at the Ministry of Health to see if we can somehow solve this problem in the near future. So then coming to do the surgery will be much easier, because as you can imagine, coming to Addis from here or elsewhere with all this equipment is not an easy task. And as you can imagine, also it's extremely expensive. So unfortunately, that's the way it is. And unfortunately, also at the same time, we can do that, and as well as some of the other teams that come from Europe and India also, to take care of these patients that are in desperate need of the surgeries. At the moment, we have a waiting list of about 3,000 children or young adults in need, in desperate need for a heart surgery. So these surgeries are life-saving, and unfortunately, like you mentioned before in the program, it would be much easier if we could treat the disease at the early stages, so we never have to get to the point where we need to do these very expensive cardiac surgeries. So this is the main issue at the moment, and hopefully some change will come soon, and then will be much easier and obviously way more available to the people of Ethiopia. That one point that I wanted to make is that we also are trying to train the local surgeons, like Dr. Jignesh said earlier. The idea is to train the local surgeons so then eventually we'll become self-sufficient and able to do the surgeries without these foreign teams coming to help them. The process is lengthy and obviously is complicated because of the complexity of the surgeries, but slowly we are building some degree of capacity, and hopefully in the near future there will be trained Ethiopian surgeons able to do the surgeries. The other point that is very important is the one that you made earlier about the healthcare workers that Ethiopia has. I believe that it's close to 38,000, if I'm not wrong.
That's correct.
And they are dispersed throughout Ethiopia. And this is one of the more basic elements. Unfortunately, not all of them are trained to diagnose the streptococcal infection, and in many of these places they don't have the penicillin that is needed to treat the infection. So at least, you know, a big step has been taken by getting these healthcare workers positioned to deal and with some of these diseases in the rural areas, you know, away from the big, you know, the cities or the medical centers.
All right. Thank you. We're past our halfway back through our program, and I would like to remind our audience that you're listening to the Global Health Forum, public service by people to people. I'm your host, Dr. Antanahab Tain. My guests this evening are Dr. Jignesh Shah, board-certified cardiologist and cardiac electrophysiologist, who's leading a volunteer faculty from the U.S. and India to provide patient care and facilitate the training of Ethiopian internists. Dr. Shah just returned from his latest trip to Ethiopia just last week. And Dr. Roberto Amado Cataneo is a board-certified thoracic and cardiac surgeon who, in collaboration with the Children's Fund of Ethiopia, performed life-saving surgeries in Ethiopian children with rheumatic valve disease. We welcome your active participation. You can ask your questions or share your comments by calling 646-595-4742 and press 1 if you would like to speak. You can also email your questions and comments to info@peoplepeople.org. We'll open up the line now. We've got quite a few callers waiting, and please wait patiently, and we'll be getting to you. So let's start with area code 203-623. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, we can hear you. Go ahead, please.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you for taking the call this evening. I have a pretty general question. I just wanted to try to get a better understanding of the difference between exercise stress tests and nuclear stress tests. And in your opinion, do you think that one is better than the other?
Dr. Shah, you want to take this?
Sure, absolutely. So exercise stress test by itself means that you are going to walk on the treadmill with an EKG attached to you. And at the peak of exercise, the EKG will tell the physician whether there is a possibility of blockage in the heart artery. If you want to make the test much more sensitive, meaning thereby being able to pick even small heart blockages, then nuclear stress test will be better, where you again walk on the treadmill, but in addition to the EKG, they also inject a nuclear dye, and they look at the distribution of the nuclear dye within your heart, and by that they make a determination whether or not there could be blockages in your heart artery. So you, in the nuclear test, you get the benefit of the nuclear dye, and it becomes much more sensitive. It is able to pick up smaller defects better than just a routine exercise stress test.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let me go to the second caller also from area code 203. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Antenna, and thank you, your guests as well. We appreciate what you're doing. So my question is, it's two things, actually. The first one is around, there's a lot of news about aspirin and its benefits. So is a full dose, 325 milligram aspirin, better than, for example, a smaller 81 milligram dose in protecting the heart? And also, how good are vitamins in doing that? And the second question is maybe slightly different, but do rhythm problems cause a heart attack, or do you need to have a blocked artery to have a heart attack? I'll take my answers offline.
I guess Dr. Shah? Yeah.
Sure. So in terms of the use of aspirin, for heart purposes, 81 milligram is good enough. For stroke prevention purposes, 81 milligram is not good enough. 325 milligrams is the required dose. That's number one. Number two, in terms of multivitamin, the data has been very questionable in terms of whether multivitamins help or not. We used to think they do, and then there is more data coming out that they actually do not help much. And then the third question you had was about the rhythm problem and whether they can cause heart attacks. By itself, rhythm problems are related to electrical issues, and they cannot cause heart attack. However, for a heart attack, you need blockages in the heart artery to give you a heart attack. In some cases, if you already have blockages in the heart artery, a bad heart rhythm problem may precipitate a heart attack, but that's not because the electrical problem is causing your heart attack, but it is because you already had significant amount of blockages in the heart artery. I hope the answers are clear.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear. I'm going to go ahead, because we've got so many callers waiting. Let me go to area code 252. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Daud. Thank you again for having this great show. I actually have only comments. Last year in February, I actually traveled with both of them to Ethiopia with Jignesh Patel to introduce him to Jimma and start the cardiology training, and also Dr. Cattaneo, while he was performing the cardiac surgeries, and the amount of energy that they spent, the amount of time they spent, and even financial expense that they took out of their personal expense is really incalculable. It's a lot. And I just personally, as an Ethiopian, want to thank them, really. Being not an Ethiopian, they actually spend both financially and also in time-wise more than any of us who are Ethiopians are doing. Just Dr. Catania, to give you an example, had in his baggage when we traveled close to almost $40,000 worth of equipment from U.S., which are perishable at that single travel. So you just have to have an idea about what they are doing. The other thing is about the rheumatic heart disease that he's talking about. It's a long road, but there is a plan that we're talking with the Ministry of Health in the future, if it's possible, to start the process, because the health posts are already there. And so I just want to comment this. Thank you.
Just wanted to add here to Dawood's comment. Thank you very much for those comments. And I just also wanted to emphasize the fact that Dr. Dawood has been extremely supportive and helpful in what we are doing, and has facilitated in many ways our connections with the higher levels of government to be able to push the issue of support for these programs in Addis and Jima, like Dr. Jignesh is leading right now. So thank you, Dawood, for your comments.
Yeah, Dawood is one of the leaders of People to People. And this reminds me that you both made presentations at the People to People's 7th Annual Global Health Conference last month. How do you think this message was received by the audience? You can both comment on it briefly.
I'll go first if you want me to. You know, I was invited to participate in a meeting in Washington, D.C. last month by Dawood. Actually, he's the one that interested me in coming to the meeting. And I must say that I was very impressed for the level of involvement by the Ethiopian people in the U.S. and the incredible work that they are doing to facilitate healthcare in Ethiopia. I think this is a very impressive movement. You know, I'm a foreigner. I'm, you know, like you said earlier, I'm from Argentina. Yeah, I have not seen a group of people, the diaspora, is so involved in trying to help the people of their own country. So it was a very impressive meeting, and the level of the presentation was extraordinary. The government of Ethiopia had representatives there, and the ambassador to the United States was there. So it was a very impressive meeting, and I'm very pleased that I was able to participate.
On my end, I was similarly impressed by the meeting in Washington, D.C. There was a lot of positive energy. I came out of that meeting energized about the program, about the project. And also, I was able to motivate a lot of people from the diaspora to participate in the project. And I've received tremendous amount of support during and after the meeting. So I'm very thankful for the invitation that I was extended for the meeting, and all the help and cooperation that people have given after the meeting.
Okay, great. Okay, let me take one more call from area code 304-279. Go ahead, please.
Question I had was, in some of the younger folks needing valve replacements in Ethiopia, you know, what sort of consideration is there into mechanical valve and the medications and the fact that they're going to need long-term medications?
I'll take that question if you want me to.
Sure.
I think it's a very good question. In the cases of young patients, like I explained, you know, the mechanical valves is a better choice because these valves will last the entirety of the patient's life. The problem with the mechanical valves is that these patients will have to take blood thinners the rest of their lives. That is Coumarin, you know, it's a common medication that we use in cardiology and cardiac surgery alike. Taking Coumarin is a difficult thing to do because it requires monitoring the level of the medication in blood. You have to take the right amount, so if you take too much, then you can have bleeding problems. If you take too little, then it's not acting and doing the job, and the valve then can clot and become non-functional. So the problem is that in places like Ethiopia, unfortunately, for the people that live far away from the larger cities where the big medical centers are, they don't have that capability to have their blood monitored to decide the amount of medication that they need to take, and that can lead to significant problems, either, like I said, either too much or too little. So taking Coumarin is not easy when you are not close to healthcare centers that can monitor the amount of medication that you are supposed to be taking. So that is one of the problems when you use mechanical valves in places like Ethiopia. Also, the other problem is that in the case of women that want to have children, if they have a mechanical valve and they are taking Coumarin, that precludes them from getting pregnant because there are obviously significant problems with pregnancy and blood thinners. So in cases of young women that need a valve replacement, the mechanical valve is not a good choice because of the issue of the Coumarin. So these patients, if they cannot receive a repair of the valve, and the valve needs to be replaced, then the tissue valve is a better choice because they don't need to take the Coumarin, blood thinner medication. Now, the problem is that with these tissue valves at this young age, the valves will not last for long, and they will degenerate, they will become calcified and non-functional, and they will need a replacement soon, you know, in life. So that's the other big problem if you use those tissue valves in younger patients. So they don't need the Coumarin, but now they might be facing a second operation when the valve fails. Does that answer your question?
It does. It does. Thank you so much.
Thank you, caller. I have to apologize for the rest of our callers because we're running out of time, but I promise if you send your questions as emails, I will forward them to Dr. Shah and Dr. Cattaneo. But before we wrap up, I'll give both of you a chance to kind of give final remarks if you want to.
I will go ahead and take that, if you don't mind.
Okay, sure. Go ahead.
So I want to impress upon all your listeners that they can also contribute to our program and project in one way or another. If your listener is working in a hospital in the U.S., they can approach the hospital administrator and see if they can donate their EKG machines, echo machines, infusion pump to our program when the hospital is upgrading their own equipment. We can use the older version, the functional equipment, and put them to good use. If your listeners are web specialists, they can help us manage our website better. If they are Ethiopian physicians or know of Ethiopian physicians, urge them to look into our program and see if they can volunteer to train Ethiopian physicians either by going there or even online. If your listener has an experience working with the NGO, they can help us secure grants to further our program. And if you still want to help my patient, Tessie, the 15-year-old, and help save her life and others like her, but don't know how, you can always email us at ethiopiacardiology@gmail.com. ethiopiacardiology@gmail.com. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Dr. Shah. Dr. Catania?
Well, you know, I just want to, again, emphasize the fact that I'm impressed with the work that people-to-people is doing, and I think that the Ethiopian community can continue to help these projects, the one that Dr. Jignesh described and the one that I'm involved with myself, with the support of Dr. Daoud, and continue to help us in whichever way you can. You can always contact us through the people-to-people organization. They know how to get hold of us. I think that it's very important to have the support of the Ethiopian people here in the U.S. so we can continue to do what we are doing to help the Ethiopian people. They truly deserve this, and we are proud to be able to help them.
Thank you both so much, and I look forward to a similar opportunity in the future.
Okay, thank you very much for inviting us.
I want to thank you, the audience, for tuning into the Global Health Forum. We invite you to join us every first Thursday of the month at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. As always, you can help shape our program by submitting your comments and suggestions through info@peoplepeople.org or People to People's Facebook page. Remember, if you're unable to tune in live, you can access the archived show using the link on the People to People website. Please check our website for more details on upcoming topics and guests. I'm your host, Dr. Antana Hapte, and I'll be back with you the first Thursday of next month with another segment of the Global Health Forum. Good night and stay engaged. We'll be right back.